Okay, so let's talk about some things, again, pertaining to Bible geography. As I developed the lessons, I found myself reading details and information about certain locations and getting a little bit distracted, perhaps because of the time that we're on. For example, as of this morning, according to the timeline, we were supposed to be in the New Testament, but I'm not there yet, and I'm not going to get there until maybe next Sunday. I think I'm going to spend this coming Wednesday night talking about the empires that develop and kind of specialize around the book of Daniel this coming Wednesday night. But this morning, I want to kind of continue talking about some things that I think may help us understand a little bit more about some of the lands and some of the developments that take place, getting us to, of course, the New Testament. Remember, the Promised Land is a land of trial and testing for God's people. It's a land that God put them in. It was a land that was, as the Bible says, flowing with milk and honey. It was a fertile land. It was a land they would receive that, as we've talked about, would have houses that they would not have to build, that they could just go in and inhabit after they would run the Canaanites out. So there was a lot to be said about the land. There was a lot to be said about their faith. And we perhaps need to do a better job in teaching people, new Christians especially, that though you are saved, you are redeemed, you have that hope, you can know that heaven is your home and the victory is yours. You can know that. And we should emphasize that as we have, and we will. But that doesn't exclude, like with the land of promise, the great trial of faith that is now yours until the day you draw your last breath and you enter into eternity. So we have to remind ourselves that this life is a wonderful blessing, especially for the Christian, but it is not without trial. And that would be the case in the land of promise. Of course, we mentioned Armageddon, or the city or the valley of Megiddo, the valley of Jezreel. And it's a location mentioned in the Bible, in the Old Testament, particularly where a lot of battles take place. There are some key battles that take place. The book of Revelation, chapter 12, refers to a spiritual type of battle that takes place in the valley of Armageddon, or what is known as Armageddon, which is just a bad transliteration of Megiddo, which is a location in the Promised Land. It's a valley area where, again, you can see, strategically speaking, many armies will come in and out of. The Egyptians come in and out of here. And I've got this written down somewhere, but it's not really the point of my lesson this morning. Don and I were talking about this last Wednesday. There was a battle in 1918 with the British in this valley, and the, again, significance of this, geographically speaking, is still today a strategic location. Well, you take the premillennialists today, the false teachers and so forth, and they pull out of the book of Revelation and try to literalize this and take and say that in this valley is where all the people are going to meet and have this final battle one day in the valley of Megiddo, or the valley of Jezreel, where the battle of Armageddon, the word Armageddon means Harmageddo. It's just a transliteration of the Hebrew. And they say again there's going to be this last and final culminating physical battle where everybody in the world is going to come right there. And we're going to go to war. God's going to win. Satan's going to lose. And then we're going to reign on this earth, Jehovah's Witness especially, in a perfect paradise, and we're all going to get along. The lion and the lamb are going to love and hug on each other. Of course, I always wonder what the lion's going to eat then. They're going to quit eating meat, start eating vegetables, but then the vegetables have to suffer too, so now we're eating vegetables, and vegetables have feelings too, don't they? You see the silliness of all this? The reality is this is not true. There is no physical battle of Armageddon that's going to take place. There's a spiritual battle going on daily. The Valley of Megiddo becomes a spiritual reference, a spiritual idea that takes up again. Because here again, Don, I was thinking about this. If you were in this timeline, if this was your home and you lived there, and you knew about this valley, grew up around it, what would you associate with this particular location, geographically speaking, if you lived in this area? Yeah. I mean, you would associate this area with the idea of perhaps war, with the idea of strategic intersection and so forth. So then you take the book of Revelation chapter 12, and I don't want to go over that. I'm just pointing you out when you, and the John, the inspired writer, the apostle John writes, and he's referring to spiritual battle and spiritual, and the principle of this location comes to play. And it becomes a picture, an idea, and an idea translates into concepts, and concepts become things you can understand principally. And there's spiritual warfare going on. And isn't that what Paul talks about in Ephesians chapter 6? That we're to arm ourselves with what kind of armament? I mean, if it were me, I'd go get me an Abrams tank and I'd drive around. Those things are pretty fast and they're flexible and they move around and they can blow some things up, you know? You know, I might arm myself with an M4 with the night vision scope on it and get me some, I'm going to go to war, right? And I want to wear the knee pads and I want the goggles and I want to look like the special ops guys. And if John or Paul were writing today, he might make reference to those types of things. But what did they use back then, and what did he tell them to spiritually attire themselves with? Fix themselves up to adorn themselves. Feet shod. The reference to shodding feet is not even a reference to putting sandals on, but shodding or actually hammering on shoes on a horse's foot. But your feet are to be shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. You know, you're going to take a physical, Bible or something and nail it on your feet? Yeah, so again, the principles. Your breastplate of righteousness, helmet of salvation, sword of the Spirit, shield of faith, you know, all these things, loins girt about with truth. That is spiritual attire. And we're fighting a spiritual battle. And again, that should point us to heaven. But I just think it's important to kind of point some of this out. Very fertile valley, kind of puts into perspective some different locations that are referenced in the Bible. Nazareth, Mount Tabor. I believe you're looking at the valley from around if I recall, Gibeah area where Saul was from, King Saul. So again, just to kind of give you some information. Now, talk about the Ishmaelites and Amalekites a little bit more. I want to get to the book of 1 Samuel and talk about King Saul in particular. And we'll talk about this from the standpoint of 1 Samuel chapter 15. Just to remind you of a sad context, but the Amalekites are told to be destroyed, and let's, in fact, look at 1 Samuel chapter 14, and notice Jonathan, the son of Saul, is fighting valiantly, a valiant man. Remember, Jonathan becomes David's best friend, is David's best friend, King David, the future king. And look at, let's just read verses 1 and following. I'm trying to give you some ideas of things I've mentioned, just to show you the context, and now that you've seen some of the land layout. Look at 1 Samuel 14, verse 1 and following. Now, it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, come and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side, but he told not his father. And Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. And the people that were with him were about 600 men. And there's the mentioning of the names and so forth. And they didn't know Jonathan had left. Look at verse 4. And between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistines' garrison. Now, just notice the reference to the passages and so forth. Those are Bible geography references. I mean, the passages would probably be in some valleys or some kind of way to kind of creep around. Anybody remember Anybody a Civil War buff? Do you like to read about Civil War, American history? 1862, 1863, before the Battle of Gettysburg, the Wilderness Campaign with Thomas Stonewall Jackson, you remember him? And if you study his battle campaigns, he took an army of men, an army much smaller in comparison to the Union Army, and he was able, because he knew those West Virginia, today West Virginia, it was still Virginia then, he knew those Blue Ridge Mountains, he knew those mountains, he knew the valleys, his men knew them, they grew up there, they lived there, and he takes an entire army. Now I point this out because some people read the Bible and think it's just a bunch of hocus pocus and they're wrong. We have stories of men who know things like in the 1860s were able to creep in and out with horses, cannons, equipment, wagons, things that make noise, and sneak in and out of a valley and come around and catch off guard an entire Union division or two and just wipe them out completely. My point in all that is we read things in the Bible and God was with them when they were fighting and they were faithful. And when they used again the sense that God gave them, whatever valley or whatever passage this was, God would work with them. And things again in masterful, mighty ways would take place. So again, verse 4, he goes up against the Philistines and he will besiege them and he will defeat them. And you have this ongoing battle. Remember, king has just been appointed, King Saul. It's relatively new. They're to be fighting. And you have this situation of Jonathan, Saul's son, fighting the Philistines. Look at the end of chapter 14. Get around to about verse 29. Then said Jonathan, my father hath troubled the land. See, I pray you, how mine eyes have been enlightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if haply the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found, for had there not been now a much greater slaughter among the Philistines, and they smote the Philistines that day from Michmash, Ajalon, and the people were very faint, and the people flew upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them on the ground, and the people did eat them with the blood. And you have this great slaughter taking place. Saul's not very happy because, again, Saul has quite the attitude. You know all that. Let's get to chapter 15. I want to talk about the Amalekites a little bit. The Amalekites, this map on the screen may give you a little perspective of just kind of the territory and the location of some of these cities and such that are mentioned. This 1 Samuel 15, verse 7, if you'll notice there in that chapter, just a passage in reference, Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah until thou comest to Shur, that is over against Egypt. It's a pretty good little trek. The location there puts a little bit more context, perhaps, idea in regard to this battle. If you'll look at the Amalekites, who were they? They were a nomadic people. The area near Kadesh Barnea, we've talked about Kadesh Barnea. It was associated with the Israelites when they came out of Egyptian captivity and wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Saul is told to utterly destroy the Amalekites because they had attacked Israel at Rephidim in the days of Moses. We skimmed over some of that. Again, back to, again, them coming out. Amalek, if you want a little bit of context, was the grandson of Esau. He is related to the Edomites. Remember, the Edomites and the Ishmaelites become intertwined together. They intermarry. In Genesis 36, verses 10 through 12, you can see the reference to where Amalek, the grandson of Esau, is referred to, which becomes the nation of the Amalekites. Not very friendly. Not very happy people. So, in 1 Samuel chapter 15, we're dealing with this context. So look at this chapter because we need to think about it from a standpoint of utter obedience and how they, how Saul was not an obedient man. But before I do that, you know what? I thought about this too. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 9. This is a story in Saul. And, remember 1 Samuel chapter 8, they're in the land here again, and, they desire a king. And look at the first king they receive. 1 Samuel chapter 9. Did I say chapter 9? I meant chapter 9. And notice here, verse 2. Talking about the Benjamite, Saul. Look at what it says about King Saul. A choice young man, verse 2, and a goodly person. And there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people. Talking about King Saul's look, physical look, likely broad shoulders, maybe a chiseled jaw. I mean, he looked like the perfect example of what a king should be like. Okay? That's important because the Bible points this out. And why would the Bible point that out, perhaps? Why would that be pointed out in regard to especially the Redeemer of the world? There you go. The Bible is, again, I thought about that this morning. Is it really a Bible geography book? Is it a book about geography, or is it a book set in a real geographical world? We understand that this is a book about character, about redemption, set in a real world. And thus, we're talking about Bible geography to try to bring out principles, to again, show you things that may help you have a little bit more flavor or context on the principle of redemption. Saul, again, what kind of a king does he become? What kind of a king is he? Look at 1 Samuel chapter 15 now. I mean, Saul gets mad at his own son. He gets mad at David. This is a very afflicted person, his heart, his character. And as Randy said, Jesus, when you think about his physical appearance and presence, was Jesus worried about pleasing people? Was Jesus, according to Isaiah's prophecy, an attractive person? It says he was not comely. They did not desire him. And that's true. When Jesus comes riding in on a little foal of a donkey, is that what you want? That's your king? But then Jesus, the one who even looks at his own family, and again, you have to see it in context. It's a Hebrew context. He wasn't being rude or disrespectful to his mother or his brethren. He was pointing out principles, though, about your mom and your dad, your mom and your brothers and sisters are looking for you in context. And he's out there, he's looking around doing all the miracles. He looks out there and he says, these are my brethren. This is my family. Again, there's a character contrast set in the real world. When we get to Jesus, he was from what location? Nazareth. And he's from the area where it's not real rich and wealthy people by any stretch. Nazareth was known as a people of tradesmen, likely carpenters, people like that. In fact, if you read about Antipas and some various other people that were in that area were over at Sepphoris. Sepphoris was a city just right down the road, which was like the chief city of the state, if you will. Sepphoris. And at Sepphoris, they had an arena, Roman arena, and they had all the uptown stuff. They had the movie theaters. That's where everybody went and hung out. But if you were from Nazareth, you were from the country. And there's a lot of emphasis upon the time historically during Jesus' time as a young boy. It's the forest was being built, the big city. And guess where a lot of the labor was coming out of? Nazareth. So there's a lot of speculation on the fact that Jesus, as a young boy, a carpenter's son, was very likely a part of maybe building the city of Sepphoris, learning that trade and being a part of that with his father. We don't know that for sure. But when you think about Nazareth and the way it may have shaped, again, the people, there's an impact. It's the difference between saying, I'm from the city and I'm from the country. I lived in an apartment or I lived on a farm. Is there an effect upon the mindset of the individual? And sure there is. Does that mean one's better than the other? Not necessarily. It goes back to character, doesn't it? But we have a tendency to miss some of the important things. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 1. So Samuel also said unto Saul, the Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore hearken thou unto the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. And Saul gathered the people together and numbered them in Telem, 200,000 footmen and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to a city of Amalek and laid wait in the valley. Now we don't know how long this campaign was, at least I don't remember if there's a reference to the timeline here, I don't think there is. But again, you look at the map here and it shows you kind of a vast location. And these nomadic people, the Amalekites, had no doubt spread about. You're talking about 350 years or so post the period of the judges. Remember, they were in the period of the judges about 350 years or so. So you go back, you know, to them wandering in the wilderness and trying to come up into the land of promise during Joshua's day. And the Amalekites were not very friendly. And God says, just think maybe 400 years later, through Samuel, the prophet, judge, to King Saul, the king, you go over there and you utterly destroy them. Now, the Amalekites were a people then that had brought about great consequence. Now, I want to talk about this just a little bit. As Christians, our main and first cause is to always be concerned with people seeking and saving the lost, lost in sin, right? And we don't ever forget that. But we also live in a world that is ruled and governed by things that God has ordained, like governments. Romans 13 clearly teaches that in the New Testament. God allows and ordains these things to take place. He desires that there be civility. He desires that there be rule and law. Of course, what he desires is that rule and law be based upon what? His truth, his righteousness. Righteousness exalts a nation, the Bible teaches. Is that proverb principle any different today? Of course it's not any different today. But we live in a world where nations, geographically speaking, are not exalting God's righteousness and not doing things right. And so therefore, the sense and sense of justice with God is still there. And he has means of taking care of those things. Now I have again, in this generation, especially this younger generation, compared to you who saw and witnessed a rough generation during World War II. Let me ask you a question, just to consider again some things that apply to us. When we fought World War II, number one, did we really as a nation, as a whole nation, really even want to get in that war? No, a majority of the people are saying, let's just leave it alone. That's Europe's problem. But those British people were really needing some help. Then you remember, this thing's waging, going on. And there was a preemptive strike on one of our islands. You remember? Pearl Harbor. And what did that do to us as a people? That's right. We couldn't run from it anymore. And as history has revealed, did you know that there were people infringing upon our coastline? Not just Japanese, but Nazis. Did you know up in Washington, the Japanese were trying to figure out ways to send these parachute-type bombs that would come across the ocean and land on our mainland and boom, bomb us? Did you know over in California they had people set up on coastal defense and ready for war? Because there was a real threat going on. And the moral fiber of our people was different then. Am I right or wrong about that? The moral fiber. Is war pretty? Is death pretty? No, it's not pretty. But you people were more accustomed to it. How many times can you remember as a young child maybe visiting the cemetery because of a young baby didn't make it? How much more common and often was death back then, and you were accustomed to it? But with the moral fiber, you knew, though you mourned, that that child was what if it died? It was safe. In the arms of Jesus. You can go read headstones, and that's the way people comforted themselves. They comforted themselves with the truth. Now today, God has blessed us with the ability, and we don't see a lot of that as much. We're not as accustomed to it. We're so far removed from suffering. But back then, people knew suffering. It was real. And today, it's amazing to me, 60 plus years after the dropping of that bomb on Nagasaki, Hiroshima, to take the will of the fight of suicidal mindsetted people out of them, we dropped two bombs and we destroyed a lot of women, children, babies, infants, sucklings, innocents. And today, people have the audacity, 70 years later, to say we shouldn't have ever done that. Those Japanese were waiting for us to come into their country and slaughter more people. They were not going to quit fighting. Those Japanese were sitting over on islands like Fiji, eating the livers out of our prisoners. They were cannibalistic. There was a mindset that was depraved, morally depraved. And our people, our presidents, had the moral fiber to say enough is enough. Harry S. Truman said, I've had it. No more loss of American lives. We knocked the will out of them. And this generation here doesn't understand that. I can still hear my granddad and people that fought in that war shaking their heads saying, son, you don't want to ever see that stuff. Now you go back to 1 Samuel 15. I have a reason for pointing that out. And Saul was told to do what? You go take the will out of them. You destroy them. Every one of them. You don't even take their spoil. We don't want any pride. We don't want any. Look at the Amalekites' cattle. Boy, they've got some nice cattle. Look at the brand. Whatever it might have been. God knew best. He said, you destroy them all. I remember what they did. and I want them wiped out. They're not going to do you any good. Morally depraved. But perhaps, and this is Bible study, Saul, good-looking man. He's every man's hero. The women, they swooned at him. Oh, Saul. The Bible talks about that. Been living in the milk of land and honey, or milk of, the land of milk and honey, right? And he's having a, got it good, God, and things have perhaps relaxed a little bit. Yeah, I'll go over here and fight. I'm fighting for you, God. Are you? I want you to look at what happens, and you remember the story. Look at verse 13. The Lord had already said to Samuel in verse 11 that it repented him that he had set up Saul to be king, sorrowed him, because he had not followed the commandments. And it grieved Samuel, and he cried unto the Lord all night. You talk about emotion. He comes to Saul in verse 13, and Saul said unto him, Blessed be thou of the Lord, I have performed the commandment of the Lord. I am real tempted to preach a lesson on that because of the attitude of today's people. I go to church. I bless God. But I cut a lot of corners in my life. And old Saul, he thought he had, he was God's man. So just listen to what it says. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. Samuel said, What meaneth then this bleating of the sheep in mine ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God. The rest we have utterly destroyed. And Samuel said unto Saul, Stay, and I will tell thee what the Lord hath said to me this night. And he said unto him, Say on. And Samuel said, When thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed thee king over Israel? The Lord set thee on a journey, and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites. You see the reference? And fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore then didst thou not obey the voice of the Lord, but didst fly upon the spoil, and didst evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, and have gone the way which the Lord sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. Brethren, we're talking about a mindset here that is messed up. I don't believe that Saul thought he was disobedient. I think Saul thought he was doing exactly what he was supposed to do. But what did God say to do? Are we listening to the commandments of God? Are we following the instructions of God? We need to stop and think about that, don't we? And how many people today think they're right where they're supposed to be? We need to think, don't we? The Amalekites, the people that tested God's people severely, and especially through Saul. All right, now this is a lesson that the whole nation would have to learn. The effect upon the nation. All right, look at verse 19. Wherefore then didst thou not obey the voice of the Lord, but didst fly upon the spoil and didst evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. Look at verse 21. But the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the chief of the things which should have been utterly destroyed. the sacrifice of the Lord thy God. And Samuel said, hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey, think about what's being said here, to obey is better than sacrifice. But I've come to church every time the doors are open. What is church? Service? What is it? And worship to God involves sacrifice. Romans 12 talks about presenting your bodies a living sacrifice. I wonder sometimes if all those dead sacrifices that were offered, sacrifices that were offered in the Old Testament, the Bible talks about it. I don't have to wander very far. How many of those sacrifices were just dead animals to God? Why? Were they really taking this animal and grooming and preparing and setting themselves and bringing this living sacrifice to God? That's it. Just show up. This is not tooting my own horn, but this is just something so you understand the difference in my mindset. All right. Like, I work and I get the privilege to preach this week, Sunday, all day. And last night, I stayed up to about midnight studying because I really wanted to be prepared, you know. I used to do this all the time, full-time preach, and I had a routine. Saturday night, I'd sit on the couch, and I'd study. I mean, all week long you do this, but you start really finishing the project. But I'm not the full-time preacher, so I don't really find that routine anymore. Last night, I sat there, and I said, Gene, I'm going to sit on this couch. I'm going to study some more. Go on to bed. Well, guess where I woke up this morning? On the couch. With my Bible and my computer and everything right there because I really was trying to make sure I was prepared. Now I hope I am. But I'm sitting there, I'm thinking about the own application of my own life right now. And I got up right at 6 o'clock as I had set, didn't go to sleep till after probably about 1. Went right back at it. Wife comes in and said, did you get any sleep? I said, oh yeah, I slept great. Again, I hope it's for preparation. We're organized. We're ready. We're thinking about this. It's a special thing. Worship is never not a special thing. It is a grand privilege. And how many people in this world aren't able to enjoy it as we are? Now back to World War II, fighting the Amalekites and all this other stuff. Did we finish those wars? The threat of Nazism, has it ever been a real threat? I mean, has it ever come back, really? I mean, there's been, the Aryan idea, but the actual nation, it's even illegal in Germany to post or to brought Nazi flags and stuff. In Germany, it's illegal. Prosecutable. Okay? Insignia and stuff, because it is such a black mark on the German people today. We finished that war. The Japanese to this day, are they one of the Allies or are they one of the Axis, if you will? We allowed a general to go in there and to set up a government. And here's one of the things that blows my mind that's not happening today. And this is no, again, slap against our military today. I think they would like this. The Japanese were not Christian people. What kind of people were they? Who was the emperor? He was a living God. That's what their mindset said. Our emperor is a living God. Christianity, the Bible didn't have free course in Japan. Now you had some Catholicism and stuff over in Germany, and Germany just had some whacked out people. But even back then, you might can figure out why they got to that point. But here you go. I'm running out of time. I know this. The Japanese people were mentally messed up. Guess what happened when we went in there and we finally destroyed their will? I can remember American missionaries flocking into that country to preach the gospel. Do you think that helped that country stabilize it and civilize it? What about Afghanistan, Iraq, and these other countries? Is it allowable? No, we're told to keep our Bibles on bases and not to get them out. We need to win these wars. We need to win them. And the only true way to win them is to allow God's influence to permeate once we've broken the will of wicked, reprobate people. Again, when I think about the Amalekites and the story of Saul, that kind of, to me, those stories, there's a lot of parallels, and perhaps you can think about that too. And pray about it. I'm not telling you to go over to Afghanistan or sign up and go fight, but I am saying that, again, pray about these things because we need to win. We win as Christians individually, but we need to win. Thank you for your attention.